Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
How should you actually pluralize octopus and platypus?
Why is the word dog one of English's biggest mysteries?
How many words have cows and pigs hiding in them?
And who are the ghosts of the jungle?
It's an etymological zoo today on Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Words from Hell and Once Upon a Word. And today we're taking a talk on the wild side, so let's set forth into the world of animal etymology.
That's right, the stories behind the names for animals. Easy. But where do we start? There are a lot of animals in the animal kingdom, Jess.
Well, how about we start with the word animal itself? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, well, it just means living thing, doesn't it? Thing that is animate, essentially.
Breathing specifically, I believe. I think the root of it means to breathe. On our last episode, we talked about the difference between like animals, vegetables, and minerals. And we distinguished that vegetables are basically any like living thing. But an animal specifically is something that is living and breathing, it seems.
Actually, you know, one definition I looked at for the Latin root of animal, which is, you know, what you'd expect it to be, specifies that it must be a non-human living creature.
That's interesting. I wonder what the distinguishing factor is and to what extent they were distinguished, because I know in like 14th century English, it could include humans, but then beasts were distinguished as the other type of living, breathing thing aside from humans.
It feels like a fundamental philosophical question, doesn't it? What separates us from the animals? Is it speech? Is it... Actually, I can't think of what anything else that is, you know, that we can sort of prove is uniquely human.
Some people say music is a distinguishing factor, but I would say that birds create music every day and that other creatures have the capacity for at least like rhythm and sound, and some have been observed creating sounds for pleasure. So I think music is just a fact of life.
Well, we have so many animals to tackle because there are some really interesting tales behind how they've got their names.
Should we start with some of the categories, like the types of animals we might talk about?
Yeah, I would really like to start with that, actually. Things like mammals, reptiles, amphibians, fish, etc. So, do you know where mammal comes from? I expect you probably do.
I definitely do, and for reasons that I'm sure you expect, but I think you should tell us about it so that we don't descend into our usual giggling.
Well, I mean, you say that. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at the notes that I wrote, which I wrote this morning before I'd had my coffee, and it says, mammal, booby animals. So mammals, yes, are the mammalian. They are the animals with mammary glands. They are the animals that suckle their young, right? That word mammal is related to the word mama, for example. And actually, people who've watched a recent video of mine will also know that the place name Manchester is related to the mammary gland and to mama.
No kidding. Is it because it has hills?
Exactly. Breast-shaped hills, specifically. Yeah, really interesting. So these mammary glands pop up all over the place. So that's what distinguishes mammals from everyone else, right, is that they suckle their young. You can look for other things that distinguish them, but there's always exceptions. For example, you have mammals that lay eggs, for example, like the duck-billed platypus. So the only thing that they all have in common is that they suckle their young, that they express milk and their young drinks it for sustenance.
Can I jump in on this? Because this is one of... Platypus applies to the same sort of question as the word octopus, and people love chatting about this one. So if you wouldn't mind, can we like add a fish for a moment, or a cephalopod rather, to the conversation
in
order to discuss a platypus. So platypus means flat-footed, literally, and the ending on it is the same as the word octopus, which begs the question, how do you pluralize it? Is it platypus, platypi, or platypodes, which is, that's the question we have a lot with octopus too. Are they octopuses, octopi, or octopodes? And many find my answer frustrating. It's that all three are correct. That is, all of them have etymological precedence.
Yeah, it just depends what language you want to evoke at the time, though, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I do have a view on this.
All right, tell me.
My view is that where possible, I opt for the English pluralization. I talk about stadiums and referendums instead of stadia and referenda. And I would talk about octopuses, not octopodes. Mm-hmm. Octopodes.
So here are my thoughts. I think choose your own adventure because octopi would be the plural of octopus if it had the Latin derived ending, the nominal ending us. But of course, it's not Latin derived, it's Greek, and us, the ending isn't really like the Latin us ending.
So hold on, Jess, hold on. To interrupt you, but you said that all three were correct.
Yes,
that one to me just sounds like that. How are you going to retrieve the fact that putting a pie at the end of it is obviously the result of a mistaken understanding of its etymology?
First of all right, we know it's made up of the Greek elements octo, eight, and pus, foot. Because it's made up of the Greek elements, it could be pluralized using the plural of foot, which is podes. That's where we get that one. However, the word octopus didn't exist in Greek. That's the thing that makes this interesting here. Okay. So the Greek term for this creature was a polypus or a polypus, meaning many-footed, which entered Latin as polypus and then was adopted directly into English from Latin. So it's a Latinized version of the Greek word. Polypus has been used as a word for like cuttlefish and inspired the medical term polyp, which looks rather like one of those sea creatures attached to your body. Its plural is also murky, but it's sometimes recorded as polypi. But because octopus is Latinized from the Greek elements, it could be pluralized with the Latin I, just as seen in the words like alumni, radii, and polypi. So octopi is correct. However, English doesn't use Greek plurals, like you said. For example, isopod is pluralized as isopods, and it has the same foot element. And then English only sometimes uses the Latin pluralization of words ending us, like campuses and viruses. So octopuses is also correct. And that also all applies to platypuses, platypi, or platypodes.
Okay, you've convinced me that there is a way to argue all three of them.
You can argue for any one of them. There is etymological precedent behind every pluralization of that word.
We come back to this every time, don't we? But the more you learn about this stuff, the more blurry it is. And the more you try to understand the rules of language, the more you realize that there just aren't any.
Of course.
So reptiles, by the way, that's an easy one. That's just Latin it's from Latin rapere, and it just means crawling, because they're the things that are low to the ground. That's about as far as it goes, really. But amphibian is I like amphibian because the name suggests that these animals are living a double life.
It quite
literally means double life, amphi and bios, right? You know, bios, like biology and stuff. It's living things.
And related to the English Latin prefix ambi, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And amphitheaters, for example, they are theaters with seating on both sides, because it can mean all, but it can also mean quite specifically both, which is it does in the case of ambi. Ambidextrous means you can use both hands. Both hands are like your right hand.
Right, ambidextrous, right-handed on both sides. And the Latin sinister for left-handed.
Is it even possible to have two right hands? One would always have to be left of the other. Anyway, it's getting
philosophical again.
Here we go. Who would have thought that animals could teach us so much about the human condition?
Oh, so much.
Fish, I think you've probably heard it said there's no such thing as a fish. And that's because we use the word fish to cover... Well, you know, it'd be a bit like saying land animals, right, for the vast array of animals that we use it for. But anyway, we know that it has the same ancient root as Latin piscis or Pisces, right? The star sign. In Old English, it was fis or fish, although that's spelled F-I-S-C, because in Old English they spelled them with an S and a C. But it's a fairly, you know, universal word across all the Proto-Indo-European languages. The word fish is there or thereabouts.
Could I call out a particular kind of fish that I think has an interesting origin?
Go on.
since we already did octopus, but that's not a fish, that's a cephalopod. Sharks were named after terrible people. People were not named after sharks. Like, the word shark was a word for a human before it was a word for a fish. Old English didn't have a general word for the broad group of cartilaginous fish species that we now call sharks. It did have more specific names. There were houndfish, sea dogs, dogfish are now still a type of shark. Hammerheads were less scarily called balance fish in English until at least like the 1740s. And then the Old Norse word for shark was har, which is related to other Germanic words for sharks, like the Dutch, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, high, and German also high. The word shark first appeared in English in the 1400s, and at the time it meant scoundrel, villain, or swindler. It wasn't a word for the animal until the 1700s, and that exact origin isn't known, but it probably means to like poke or something from a Germanic language, or to stir, but it's probably related to a German words for villains and evil people. Exactly like how the transition happened is probably just a comparison between the fact that like terrible people were predatory and so are these animals. But I also really like the Greek and French words for shark. The French requin means grimacer, which is scary. The Greek, I'm probably not going to pronounce this right, carcharius, literally jagged biter. The words for sharks are vast and interesting, but didn't originally include shark.
I think I told you before on this podcast that once I was looking this up and found that an old seafaring term for a shark was a water lawyer.
Ah, that's funny. Oh, that's funny. That's in Melville. I forget which Melville book it is. It's not Moby Dick, but he writes about brown sharks, which he called sea attorneys. The tiger shark, he said, it has a rude, savage swagger as well as a distended mouth and collapsed conscience. And then the white shark was called the ghost of a fish.
You know, these people are just playing an essential role in our justice system, and this is how we treat them. Outrageous. From fish, can I move on to the invertebrates?
Yeah, let's do it.
So the invertebrates are, you know, vertebra means joint, actually. It's referring to the joints in your spine. And so invertebrates don't have them. They're spineless. They may have all the courage in the world, but they're spineless at the same time. Among the invertebrates are the insects, insects meaning insections, really, quite literally. I mean, it's from the Latin to cut into, right? Here's an interesting thing. Entomology, right? So the first part of that, not etymology, right? It's very easy to confuse these things. But entomology means the same in Greek as insect means in Latin. It means
segmented.
To cut into.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Romans have done, yes, it does mean segmented. That's the next logical step, but it literally is from a verb meaning to cut into. And what the Romans have done is take the Greek word, translate it into their own language, and then use that, which would be like us calling them cut intos. Cut-ups.
That's kind of
neat. It's kind of funny.
How many times per week are you told the following joke?
I already know,
you know
where it's coming.
You know what I'm going to say. People who confuse etymology and entomology bug me in ways I can't put into words.
And it's a goodie.
Oh, yeah. But people tell it to me like basically daily.
They're right to think that I would enjoy it.
Yes.
I did the first time, maybe even the first, second or third time.
Maybe 30 times.
Move on to the arachnids, right? Who are also cut up into pieces, but are not insects. Arachnid just comes from the Greek word for spider, quite specifically. Are those also in the arachnid family are the scorpions, the mites, yeah? And, the other ones, it's the ticks.
Oh,
our friends,
yeah.
The ticks.
Oh, those are awful.
I if we could just remove a group, I'm getting rid of the arachnids.
Oh, fair enough. I like spiders personally, but I could do without ticks. I find them on me all the time out here because we have a lot of deer. So getting rid of those as soon as possible is ideal.
I would not know how to react if there was a tick on me. we have an extraordinary fear of ticks here in Europe, by the way. Yeah, I mean, like Lyme disease is like the number one terror.
Typically, I don't find them biting me, but if you do, if you get it off in 24 hours, I am told it's not as serious.
So the bad thing is if you don't notice it happen.
Or if you pull the body off and leave the head in you.
Oh, grief. No. I'm going to say we get rid of them. I know people are going to be upset with me.
Yeah, we can cut that if you like.
Standing by it.
We have talked about different words for spiders, which is always very interesting. One of my favorite, since we were on insects a moment ago, one of my favorite origins of an insect is the praying mantis. It's, by the way, it's praying as in praying to a god, not praying as in praying on small creatures, but that's understandable.
But it's a perfect egg corn because it does make so much sense.
Right. They both look as if they are praying to a god, and they definitely prey on other smaller insects. But it comes from the same Proto-Indo-European root as words like mnemonic and memory and memorial and remember. And mantis itself means like a diviner or a seer or a prophet.
That's very cool. They do look wise, not only because they're praying, but their posture is immaculate.
Their scientific name is Mantis religiosa as well, which like adds to the praying part.
That is good. Although, I mean, they have some quite nasty post-coital behavior.
Oh, yeah. There's some like head biting off and all kinds of things. In the insect world, females benefit the most from survival.
Yeah, and they're usually the bigger, aren't they? The female of the species. Mollusks. Can I briefly mention the mollusk? The mollusk comes from the Latin mollis, meaning soft.
Ooh,
which I like.
That's interesting. Many mollusks are not soft.
No, exactly. So originally it was just the soft, gooey ones, and then they brought in the ones with the shells after that. But it means it's related to the French moelleux, which is a really nice word to describe a sort of oozing soft chocolate cake or something like I, whenever it's a word that comes up if you've got yourself a nice chocolate fondant or something like that, moelleux. But also more basically, it's linked to our word melt.
Oh, neat.
As well, huh. Mollusk and melt.
That reminds me of, back to cephalopods, squid is thought to be a sailor's variant of the word squirt, referring to their inking.
That makes perfect sense. Oh, I like that.
And a group of squid is called a shoal, but many enlightened and clever people advocate for calling it a squad, and I quite agree with them.
Why would you miss that opportunity?
Of course. Calamari, too, is also pen-related. The word Latin calamarius means pertaining to pens.
Oh, like calligraphy?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wait, no, that's not right. Calligraphy means beautiful writing. This is unrelated. This is related to calamus, which literally means reed.
Good catch, Jess. I nearly went off on my own little etymological flight of fancy there. Crustaceans is the last one I'm going to mention.
Oh, let's do it.
From the Latin crusta, meaning shell. So actually, basically the opposite of mollusk in terms of its crunchiness.
Oh, yeah. Very crunchy.
And it just refers to the fact they've got hard exoskeletons. So what we're talking about crustaceans, we're talking about, lobsters and crabs. Are crabs crustaceans? Why am I doubting that? That's something I've known since I was a child.
Crabs are definitely crustaceans.
Uh-huh. You know, if you can know too much sometimes and things start to get a bit confusing. So those are the groupings, the classes, the families of animals.
Very nice. Now let's talk about some specific animals. Let's do like some of the basics. Like one that I think is really interesting, and people will probably mention this in the comments, is bear, which is a euphemism probably. It means like the brown thing or the brown animal. Apparently there was another word perhaps related to the same root as like arctos for bear, but we don't know what it is because apparently people were too scared to say its name and just called it brown thing.
It's amazing, isn't it? Don't mention the bear. And also, I think there's a possibility that the arctos words, correct me if I'm wrong here because I'm just half remembering, but I think they're related themselves to honey.
Ooh, neat.
Yeah, so in themselves, they are also euphemistic. So it's possible that we don't...
Honey-eating thing.
Yeah, exactly. So we have no idea what the original, I mean, we obviously don't know our original word for many things, but we there's no trace of what the first idea that came to our ancestors' head was when they saw this big, lugging, terrifying beast, other than just, presumably.
Now, what about like the animals that live in our house, like dogs and cats. I know dog has an interesting origin. Would you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. This is something that I refer to as the dog mystery. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone else does this. I Googled it earlier thinking, oh, I'll find out. I'll just double check some of the facts on this. And the only thing I found was one of my own videos. So I think I might have invented the phrase. Well, let's start using it. This is the dog mystery. And the mystery is that we don't know where the word dog came from. Right. If this word, you see it in any other language, it's referencing it in English. For example, there are specific breeds in other languages, like in French, there's dog, which is D-O-G-U-E. And that is referencing the English word for dog. All of the other Germanic languages use a word along the lines of hound. Mm-hmm. Right. And all of those are also related to words like canine and stuff. Actually, there's an interesting link that you want to mention.
That's
right.
Because
you hinted at it earlier.
The word cynic means dog-like. It's from the Greek kynikos. The cynics were philosophers who followed the teachings of Aristophanes, who was named basically the absolute dog or the dog guy. And they were dog-like for kind of a debatable reason. It could have been their lifestyle. They were like ascetics who lived kind of a coarse, wandering life like a dog, according to the Greeks, due to Aristophanes' philosophy that all one needs is like virtue and strength of spirit to survive. Apparently dying of exposure was not a concern. Or it might be a reference to where they hung out. The Kynosarge, or the gray dog, was a gymnasium near Athens where Antisthenes taught.
The amazing thing is that the words cynic and the word hound, so cynic and hound, come from exactly the same Proto-Indo-European route. They've just passed through different branches of the Indo-European languages, you know, one through Greek and one through the Germanic languages, which is amazing. But as I started off saying, we don't know where the word dog comes from. That ending, that og thing, is peculiar, and it is consistent across animal names only in English and not in any of the other Germanic languages. So for example, we don't know why we call frogs, when all of the other Germanic languages, or at least the West Germanic languages, so the ones from our branch of the Germanic languages, German and Dutch, call them something along the line of Frosch, which it is in German, or it's Vos or Vos in Dutch. We used to have the word Frosch, which was F-R-O-S-C, but for some reason we started calling them Froggers. It might have been to be sort of a bit cute about it, but we seem to have done the same thing with dog. We seem to have done the same thing with hog as well. So that there are some similar sounding words in the Celtic languages, right? They're very similar to hog. It's more like hoch, I think, in Welsh. But the old English word hog did not just refer to pigs. It referred to the males of just about any farm animal. So it doesn't quite work that it would be from that Celtic origin where it does refer to, you know, a sow or some sort of hog. Then stag as well is another one of these sort of g words that are a bit unusual. Male deer specifically in its fifth year is what the original meaning of stag was in English. There are words related to it in other languages, but they just mean males of all kinds of species, right? And what's the other strange one? Pig is the really, really weird one, because, you know, have you ever tried to do that thing which we will have done when talking about you know, the influence of French and Germanic, and you go, oh yeah, so you've got cow and beef, you know, you've got mutton and sheep. The pig one, you have to kind of do a bit more work, because you can't really use pig as the example, because there's no obvious Germanic precedent for the word pig, right? The earliest trace we've got of it is in this term, pickbret, right? Which meant an acorn. And we know that pigs like to eat acorns. They like to snaffle around for them. So we've deduced from that that term maybe meant something like pig bread, like feed for pigs. And so that's the best idea we've got of where our word pig comes from. But at the same time, it's not a very satisfying route.
That's so
it's another
so
of these
interesting
g words that we don't know where they've come from. All these animals in English that are like that. And then there's bird. We don't know where the word bird comes from either.
And it was Brid originally, right?
Yeah, it was. The letters swapped round, but there are no corresponding words to bird in any of the other Germanic languages. And we know that in the Romance languages, there's nothing like it either. Bizarre.
All of this is interesting, though, because like a lot of these words ended up folded into, in other languages, they end up folded into our words for other types of animals. Like we've talked before about how porpoise means pigfish. And then pigs are in a bunch of other animal names too. Like an aardvark is an Afrikaans Dutch word meaning earth pig. And then porcupine comes from the old French porc espine, meaning spiny pig or thorny pig. One of my favorite things about porcupine, by the way, is that it has had so many different... so many different letter salad spellings and pronunciations, like pork de spine, portapin, pork pen, pork and pick, porpoint, and of course, the one from Hamlet, porpentine, like quills upon the fretful porpentine, which I love that.
It's interesting how these mispronunciations, they sometimes catch on as well. For example, albatross is one of them. This is an amazing thing. Sorry, to move on to birds.
Let's,
I suppose, we were sort of talking about birds. Mm-hmm. But did you know? Do you know what Alcatraz means?
No, I used to know this, but I don't know right now.
It's Portuguese for pelican.
I mean, I'm assuming it's a rock that a lot of pelicans were on before they put a prison there.
One assumes so, yeah. But our word for albatross was at one point much closer to the word Alcatraz, but it's thought that it was influenced by albus, which is Latin for white, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got these big white birds, so they started calling them albatross. Like that. But actually, the original Alcatraz in Portuguese comes from Arabic. I mean, it's words that start with al almost always come from Arabic.
Mm, of course.
Although another one that doesn't is alligator, but I'll get onto that one in a second. But the word Alcatraz in Portuguese comes from algatas, from Arabic, which just means sea eagle.
Another bird word that you wouldn't expect is pedigree, which is from the phrase, the old French phrase, pied de grue, meaning foot of a crane. Basically, it's implying that like the genealogical charts that forked looked like a crane's feet. They're like long toes, essentially.
You just don't expect to find a word meaning that.
Right.
Coming from that origin. Mm-hmm. Actually, that sentence I've just used can apply to absolutely everything you ever say on this podcast.
So true.
But it's true. And, you know, these two things don't seem to be linked at all. I think, oh, it's because of the shape of it. Of course it is, which is slightly abstract. Anyway. The alligator, by the way.
Yeah,
I'll just get
that.
It out of the way, since mm-hmm. I just mentioned it. It is from another language, obviously, but it's from Spanish, from El Legato, which is the lizard. In fact, we did just call them legatos for a bit, eventually put the al on the start of it. Well, it became al. It would have started off as el legato.
I've also I've read that we don't know the exact origin or meaning of crocodile, but one of the false origins that I think is interesting is that it meant gravel worm, essentially, from a couple of Greek elements.
Yeah, but that is folk etymology happening a couple of thousand years ago, right? It is the Greeks who very deliberately made that word into worm of the stones or pebble worm or whatever you want to be. Crocodilos means that, but it's likely to have been them making sense of a word from some other language and turning it into something that sounds, you know, that makes sense to them, even though it's not very good, is it? Pebble worm.
Not ideal.
You're rather doing it down. Although people talk about worms as being like a dragon, right?
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Absolutely.
Also, we had a lot of different names for a crocodile. And actually, it was more common to call it a cockadrill than a crocodile. Mm-hmm. Because in French, it was cocadrille when it first went into English. So the first...
Medieval Latin, too, I think, had a similar...
Ah.
Cocodrilos.
Okay, mm-hmm. So it's crocodilos in Greek, and then they swap those letters around, do they, in Latin?
Mm-hmm. Seems like it.
Typical. Making it as complicated as possible.
I bet that's from, like, bestiaries, because that was medieval Latin specifically. The classical Latin is closer to the Greek. But then I bet when we started getting these books of creative interpretations and applications of morality on different types of animals, I bet all kinds of letters and thoughts were introduced. And that's where we get some of that folk etymology that appears in English, too.
While we're semi in the water, though, with the crocodiles, can we talk about the hippopotamuses?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hippopotami?
Mm-hmm.
Hippopotamus. Podes?
Our water horses.
Yeah, the Potamus bit, meaning river, is the same as you find in Mesopotamia, right, which means between rivers, which I think is kind of satisfying. Also, another name for the seahorse is the hippocampus.
Which is also a little C-shaped part of our brain.
Exactly. Yeah, it was seahorse-shaped.
Seahorse-shaped, yes, exactly.
Oh, and hippocampus, by the way, doesn't just mean seahorse. It means horse sea monster.
Horse sea monster. That's also, otters are also, they share a root with the word hydra, which I think is very fun. They're like, what? They're tiny sea monsters. Mm-hmm.
Those two words seem so far apart.
Right? They seem so different. But it's basically the Proto-Indo-European root. It means like water creature, and hydra and otter both ultimately emerged from that root. However, in 17th century English, sea otters were also sometimes called sea apes.
Have you got any apes on your list?
I don't have a lot of apes on my list.
I don't have any apes. We could have talked about the orangutan, right?
Which, yeah, that's the only one I have. Person of the forest.
Yeah, that's right. People say old man of the forest. Is there an implication in the name that it's old, or is it just person of the forest?
I don't know enough about Malay in order to tell you, because that's where it comes from.
Well, everyone's homework, go and check. Is it old man of the forest, or is it just person of the forest? Lemur's a creepy one. Lemur means ghost. In Latin, it's from lemures.
They're little white faces, maybe?
They're little white faces, and they're nocturnal as well. So the way they move around during the night, and also with those creepy little faces of theirs. Yeah, lemurs, etymologically speaking, just ghosts.
Ooh, I don't know. That's kind of a little bit cute, maybe in a creepy way. But I also prefer things that are both cute and creepy.
Would you like to be haunted? There's a bit of me that wouldn't mind being haunted a little bit, just to see what it's like.
Right, maybe by a friendly lemur.
Fine. Casper the friendly lemur.
Another cute one is pangolin, which literally means something that rolls up, and that's another one from Malay.
Malay have given us some very beautiful words.
Oh, here's an interesting one. This isn't in the primate family at all, but I wanted to get your take on the difference between elk and moose, because I think that in certain parts of the world we have, oh no.
I struggle so much with all of these, with elk, moose, caribou as well. Although I think caribou is caribou a reindeer?
Caribou and reindeer are the same species. Caribou just tend to live in North America, and reindeer in Europe and extended parts of the world.
Right. Got it.
And then a moose for me is like this big, giant, I mean, they're all huge, but yeah. Moose are bigger than elk.
Yeah, they are different. I mean, for a long time, I thought they were the same thing. And I thought maybe one of them was like a Canadian word and one was something else. But actually, you put a picture of each next to each other. And yeah, they're just obviously different animals, the moose and the elk.
But moose are called elk in certain parts of the world, I believe.
Ah, does that mean they're a type of, you know, we're not shining many lights on things here, but that's interesting. So a moose could be a type of elk. What about bison and buffalo?
Well, let's see. Buffalo, my understanding of this, because we have bison over here. These are the ones with like the big hump on their back that's also like curly, furry, and they've got lower heads and shorter. The American bison is what I associate with that. They are sometimes called buffalo. But apparently they are not technically buffalo. And meanwhile, buffalo live in basically any other part of the world, and they look more like cows with big humps.
And there's that thing, isn't there, about the longest sentence you can construct in English using just one word.
In a row.
Buffalo, 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 buffalo. Do we go into explaining that, do you think?
If you, it bends my mind every time. If you've got a top of mind, please go for it. But I still, like, every time I redo it, I have to bend my head around it.
Okay, I can do it. So what you need to make this sentence work is you need the word buffalo meaning a bison. You need the word buffalo meaning the place. And you need to know that the word buffalo can also be a verb meaning to bully, right? So if we just leave the word buffalo only representing the place buffalo, and then we replace all of the buffaloes that mean the animal with the word bison, just to help us out, even though we've discussed that is a complicated question. And then we swap the word buffalo meaning to bully with the word bully. What you get is buffalo bison bully, bully buffalo bison, or the buffalo bison, that buffalo bison bully also bully other buffalo bison.
That's amazing.
And that's how you end up with buffalo, 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 buffalo.
That's a particularly egregious garden path sentence, right? Uh-huh.
It's not very useful.
Right. I mean, same as the other classic one is the horse raced past the barn fell. And if you like break it down, it's the horse that was raced past the barn fell down. But it's a tricky one because like once you hit fell, your brain has to go back and reinterpret the sentence.
Makes more sense written down than out loud, right? Because you're relying on past and past mm-hmm. being the same, S-S-E-D and A-S-T. Remind us what a garden path sentence is.
Basically, it's like what I said. When you get to the end of the sentence, you have to go back and read it again to make sense of it. And in some cases, it's harder than others.
So it led you up the garden path the first time. You thought you were understanding it. Then you get to the end and you go, oh, I'm not where I thought I was. We talked about dogs. We didn't really talk about cats, did we?
No, let's talk about cats. This one is pretty straightforward, honestly. Cat has basically meant cat forever.
And all across Europe, the words are almost exactly the same. It's kind of amazing. One of the funny things about cats is, you know how we say pussy cat?
Mm-hmm.
There are other languages where they have a sort of cute word for a cat that is along that sort of ps sound.
But that's also how some people in some languages call a cat, right? Like ps, ps, ps.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder what it is about cats that makes us make this sort of ps thing, this sort of plosive followed by a sibilant ps. But there's something about it.
It might be their little like hissing sounds and things like that, maybe.
Yeah, but why would you want to imitate the thing they do when they're stressed? That's what I don't get.
Hmm.
Anyway, I'll ask my cat and see if it
good question.
Knows. Cats pop up in the names of a lot of other animals, and some that are quite surprising, actually. For example, the chameleon.
Yes.
Has got a hidden cat inside it. There's two interpretations of chameleon. It either means ground lion, although there's actually such a thing as a ground lion, right? Or it means really small lion, because that first part, the kame bit, goes back to a root that essentially means low down. So you could think of it as a dwarf lion.
That's funny.
You could think of it as a ground lion. And I guess it's because it's got that little sort of mane-y thing going on, right?
I suppose. But the first thing I think of when I look at a chameleon is definitely its crazy eyes. Like, so I feel like that should be the more prominent naming feature.
It's funny that how sometimes they don't go with the obvious. Like it reminds me of how in French, the word for bat is chauve-souris.
What is that?
It means bald mouse.
Oh, nothing.
And the obvious thing that differentiates a bat from a mouse is not the fact that it has less hair on its head.
Right. I guess the wings are relatively hairless, so that's interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, they really should point out the fact that it flies. Even the word bat is referenced to the fact that it bats its wings, right?
Speaking of mouse, while we're on that one, The word muscle literally means like little mouse. The Latin musculus referred to both muscles, but also mice, apparently, because it looked like mice running underneath your skin when you flexed your muscles, which, I mean, that seems like a matter of interpretation, but not one that I want to think about very much. So you're literally, if you're muscular, you're also literally mousy. And then another one, there was another word in English for a little while, lacertus, which also meant muscular, and it means lizardy for the same reason.
Yeah. Well, like it's like there's a lizard crawling underneath your skin.
Yeah, basically.
No. I mean, I'm glad that they couch these in incomprehensible other languages, you know.
Of course.
Because when languages don't do that, like here in Germany, they have a lot of medical terms where it's just incredibly literal, right? For example, the placenta, right, is called the mother cake in German. But, you know, in the same way as I'm saying mother cake now, if we were doing this in German, I would just be saying the same thing. I'd be saying, oh, our word for what some people call placenta is mother cake, obviously.
That's like, horrible. Ooh. I don't like that at all.
I don't like that. Yeah, I know. I mean, this is the thing, right? We effectively euphemize by using Greek and Latin, don't we? We stop ourselves having to think too much about what these things are, although at the same time, it can kind of obscure what they mean and make them a bit harder to understand.
A couple interesting examples of like other animals hiding in other words. There are cows in a few words. One is peculiar, peculium, the Latin peculium literally means property in cattle, which also lingers to in the word peculiar to, like belonging solely to in the property sense. And then the odd sense arose after the term evolved to mean distinguished or special, describing a person who had great wealth or renown and presumably apparently was rich enough to have a bunch of cows.
And I think I can guess what the other hidden cow is.
Oh, yeah. This is one that has come up a lot in the past 4 years. Yeah. Vaccine.
Yeah, I think awareness of it now is much higher than it was before.
Exactly. Vaccine means cow because a doctor named Edward Jenner developed a vaccine to prevent people from getting smallpox by injecting them with a small amount of the cowpox virus.
And to vaccinate is to cow, to render cow, to cow eyes.
And then there's one more cow word. Bucolic means pleasantly pastoral, but literally like cow tending, from the Greek elements bous and kolos.
Oh, that's pleasant.
Sitting on a hill tending cows.
And we talked about little cats, but let's talk about big cats as well, because leopard has got two cats in it, because it was originally thought to be a hybrid animal of a lion and what was the other one? A jaguar?
Panther, I believe.
Panther, that's mm-hmm. it. Yeah, it was a panther. And yeah, so the leo bit means lion and the part means panther. Actually, it's kind of obvious when you think about it, isn't it? It's not actually a hybrid at all. It is its own species. But nevertheless, the reason that we pronounce it leopard, but spell it leopard, is that the French spelling that we took was L-E-U-P-A-R-T. It was leopard. Right. And so that we continued with that pronunciation. But then the French did that thing that really annoys me when it happens in English, which is they looked back at the Latin root of the word and said, oh, there's supposed to be an O in there. So they popped an O in there. And then we took their new spelling as well.
Oh, that's
so we've
funny.
Ended up with leopard spelt one way and pronounced another.
My understanding is there's also some confusion around exactly what panther means too. Apparently it's thought to mean something like all beasts, but it might not. That might have been folk etymology applied to a word from a different language.
And one of the big cat is the jaguar, because it's quite interesting because it comes from a language that... Well, languages that we haven't talked about on the podcast before, which are the languages of Guarani and Tupi, which are spoken in sort of Paraguay, Brazil. And they had a word that was jaguarete, right? Which meant a jaguar, right? But if you take off the ending there, the ete at the end, that specifically means true, right? So if you take that off and you just have the jaguar, then what you have is their general word for a carnivore, right? For a carnivorous animal. So their word for a jaguar, jaguarete, means true carnivore.
Ooh.
Which I think is kind of cool.
I've I took archaeology in undergrad. I had an anthropology minor. And one thing that I thought was really interesting is one of the reasons that some early human species were thought to live in trees, even though they didn't, is that one of their primary and most successful predators were leopards and jaguars, who would take the little proto-human up into the tree and they would find bones beneath the tree.
Wow.
So they were okay. One of our OG predators. So it certainly makes sense that we would call them carnivores.
It's funny how they look for clues and the clues can just take you to completely the wrong place.
Another one with lions hidden in it is dandelion, right? It's a lion's tooth. And that's referring to the jagged shape of the leaves, which is supposed to look like a lion's tooth, perhaps also influenced by the sunny yellow bloom that they get on them. Maybe it looks a little bit like a lion's mane.
Because in French, it would be dandelion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Exactly. That's a great direct borrow. And there are a ton of other funny words for dandelions throughout history. They've been called blowballs and clocks. They've been called pissabeds and peabeds and wetabeds because they may also have been used as a diuretic at some point or an herbal supplement.
But don't call it a pissabed. If it's supposed to be a treatment and it's making that happen, it's bad treatment.
It's also entirely possible, like in some, I believe in some forms of Italian, they're also called literally like dog pisses because they're yellow and they're found along the side of the road. But they're also called cankerwort, which is cool. It means like crab grass, essentially, since we talked about crabs and we've also talked about cancer and carcinose on a previous episode. There was also Milkwitch and Irish Daisy, which is unfortunately making fun of Irish people.
I think definitely we've got to do a planty episode at some point.
Oh,
I mean,
course.
We've touched on the fruit and veg, but we've got to get on the flowers and the trees next time.
After I finish my next book, I'm going to write a book about, it's going to be called something along the lines of like the etymologist's field guide. And I'm going to work with scientists and naturalists to infuse it with actual scientific information in addition to word origins.
Beautiful. Ever informative. So you don't get what I have occasionally delivered during this episode,
where we're
which
like,
is the, know what the words mean. Haven't got a clue what the biology is. Never mind.
I can close us out with some rapid-fire dog breed origins because these get kind of fun and interesting. Dachshund means badger hound from the old High German Das for a badger. They were bred to pursue badgers into their holes, which is why they're shaped like that.
Oh, right. They're like a little sausage so they can fit down the hole.
Exactly.
Oh, man. They're really big fans of those here. Really
oh, yeah.
Fans.
I mean, I bet they are. It's a German breed, isn't it? Let's see. Corgis. That's from the word corgi is the Welsh word for dwarf dog, which is adorable.
They are adorable as well.
The Shiba Inu is a Japanese dog. It's usually translated as little brushwood dog, referring either to the color of their fur or the landscape in which they were bred to hunt. A neat one is Saluki, is an ancient Sumerian word meaning plunge earth, because they were thought to be launched off the backs of camels by Bedouin hunters to give them a running start after prey.
Wow. So they would plunge to the ground.
Mm-hmm. And then the Shih Tzu is from a Chinese word literally meaning lion dog, where there we have another lion hiding in a word. Schnauzer, of course, means growler in German. The Basenji is from the Lingala language of the northeastern Congo, and its name, its full name, is a phrase thought to mean dog of the villagers, or, you know, kind of local tame dog. And then mutt is originally short and was originally an insult for humans. It meant mutton head, but apparently those dogs were also especially not very bright, or it could be related to the idea that they were perhaps being scolded for sheep worrying, which was definitely frowned upon.
So it started off as an insult for humans, went into being an insult to dogs, and now is an insult to humans based upon that insult for dogs.
Yep, basically.
Well, I enjoyed digging into doggy etymology with you there.
This has been both domesticated and wild, and I've had a great time.
Oh, you saved that one up. I like that. People say wild a lot these days, by the way.
I mean, they sure do.
Yeah. Thank you so much for another great episode, Jess. Thank you to you for watching this episode. Leave your comments below the YouTube channel, and you can send us an email if you fancy.
WordsUnraveledPod@gmail.com. Don't forget, that's with two L's.
We'll catch you in the next one.